The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Hello. It's political conference time and the manoeuvring has spread to the world of books. As Labour's new leader squares up to the challenges ahead, two heavyweight commentators are on hand to advise him on where his predecessors went wrong and what he should now be doing to put it right. Polly Toynbee of The Guardian brings us the verdict. Did Labour change Britain? And Will Hutton of The Observer, who's also heading up the Coalition's Fair Pay Review, has just launched Them and Us, Politics, Greed and Inequality, Why We Need a Fair Society. Both came into our podcast studio earlier this week to give the gist of what they're arguing. If you think you've heard this before, do bear with us. It's not the same as the potted version that went out on Monday.
What I'm trying to argue is that we have capitalism. We're unlikely to socialise it any time soon. So the open question is how to get the best out of it. The best of capitalism is when people take genuine risk, create genuine wealth, and they do it, I argue, when societies are open and in a condition of, you know, codependency between the public and the private. And actually, you know, capitalists themselves say, you know, we do great things when we're hunter-killers, when we're allowed to succeed in our Darwinian struggle for survival, and everything that we do needs as little constraint as possible. And I argue that actually that's not right. Actually, that capitalism succeeds better when actually you take care of really important values like fairness, proportionality, and actually recognise the importance of public institutions. That's the heart of the book.
Right, Polly, the verdict.
Well, we are the antidote, in a sense, to all of the books that have come out by the key players, the Blair, Mandelson books, many more to come, about the melodramas that went on at the top, horrifying though they are. Our book is about the hard outcomes. It's purely about the policy, very little about the people, the personalities, and the rows that went on. So that it's looking at where did Labour start in 97, where did they end, and what happened in health, in education, in fairness and redistribution, looking inevitably at their foreign policy, and trying to assess to what extent Labour made the best use of the golden opportunity it had in 97 when, you know, red carpet was rolled out for it, the economy was set fair. And did they make as much difference as they could have done with the chances that they had?
The Verdict is the third book Polly and her co-writer David Walker have written about the last Labour government. They believe they've recorded everything the party did and didn't achieve. And Polly thinks they made definite improvements in health, education and equal pay. Will Hutton became a publishing pundit back in 1995 when he produced The State We're In. It was expected to be the Bible of the new Blair government, but he admits now that it didn't turn out like that. They immediately dropped it and left what he calls the structures of capitalism as they were. His assessment of new Labour years is accordingly more pessimistic. Neither book, interestingly, wastes many words on the Iraq War. Polly even writes that the war was not the defining event of the Labour years, which may come as a bit of a surprise to the Miliband brothers. I asked them both to defend this position against those who might argue that the war was indeed the central issue.
Our chapter on foreign policy makes it clear that the Iraq War was simply Labour following the policies of British government since the war, leading us catastrophically, disastrously, blindly into following the Americans, whatever they do. When they say jump, we jump. And it was a disaster. Was it the defining disaster? I'm not sure that it was. I think it was amongst them. I think that the Faustian Pact with the city that eventually, of course, led to the great crash in the state of British economy was what really lost the Labour the election. After all, Labour did win the election after the Iraq War in 2005, and it lost because of the financial crisis.
I read a book called The Writing on the Wall on China, and I consecrated a chapter to the Iraq War, which I had the strongest feelings about at the time. It was an illegitimate invasion. There was absolutely no consequential thinking about how you construct a state after you pull down a state.
Can I add a ditto to that? Because this is our third book. We've done an audit of Labour's first term, and obviously the one about the second term was a lot about the Iraq War.
Yes, no, absolutely. I just thought that we had to put that on record. Let's just move from there to the form these books do take. Polly, your book is very richly anecdotal, isn't it? I mean, it opens with an account of the 14-year-old Portuguese girl who silenced a rally during this year's Labour election campaign with an account of her family's struggle to survive on the minimum wage.
We have some vignettes all the way through of real people's experience of different aspects of life during those 13 years, because otherwise it's an incredibly hard, fact-dense book. It's a sort of ready reckoner of everything you need to know about all the programmes that they did and didn't do in education, health and so on. You know, a hospital manager, a junior down at the job centre, just people who were doing better or worse as a result of different things that Labour did and their views of it.
Will, if I describe this as yours as a wonks book, I'm not at all referring to the way it's written. In fact, as Gidelski, who I mentioned before, reviewed it in The Guardian, described it as a tract for our times, passionate, erudite and with much common sense. However, one of your aims is to advise government, isn't it? To tell government what to think.
There's a section where I try to kind of dissect what constitutes fairness, which is for every man and woman. Then there's a section where I try to kind of examine how that plays out. And having got that far in the first two sections, the last section, I felt compelled really to try to spell out what I think all this means for how you do economic, social policy, implications for the media, the constitution, and actually for government fiscal policy, where, you know, I take an even tougher line almost than Polly. I mean, I think that the aftermath of credit crunches are astonishingly difficult to manage. We know from history that economies remain depressed for years, if not decades afterwards, and that to a similar overlay upon that, a programme of deficit reduction this aggressively, in which so much of the burden is taken from public expenditure rather than taxation. And I think particularly property. Baby boomers are sitting on many billions of equity which could be accessed to help lower this deficit. We have a government that wants to, that is putting the reduction of the national debt as a share of GDP when it is lower than it's been for most of the last 300 years. We're putting that before sustaining our science base, before investing in a new network of banks, before investing in how you might change the welfare system to avoid some of the dreadful kind of disincentives to go to work.
Sadly, though, Labour, as we say in our book, Labour had already committed itself in the most extraordinary, ludicrous Fiscal Responsibility Act to doing not as much, but pretty severe retrenchment of a similar kind, to cut the deficit in half within 4 years for no good reason, purely as a political gesture. All right, Tories have gone much worse. They're going to do 50% more. But I don't think Labour gets off that hook either of having understood what Keynes said about the Great Depression.
So who are your target readers for these books? They're very ambitious books, aren't they? You see yourself as players.
As players? I see myself more as
I see you as players, certainly. Perhaps I should say that.
That's interesting. I see us as, you know, people who helped to construct the national conversation. The state we're in was read by, you know, many hundreds of thousands of people. If you can get it right, you know, there is a concerned citizenry out there. I'm always amazed when I go to literary festivals to talk about my book. You know, you will find hundreds and hundreds of people turning up, and they want to hear you, and they want to ask you questions, and when you sign your book, you know, they want to engage you, and they want answers.
Quite so, right. Literary festivals have become the new political forum. People still don't want to go to political meetings much, but they turn out in droves for anybody who's got a political book, because they want to join in and they want to have a debate, and you know, the tents are always packed out for our political books. And I think there are very few forums where people feel they can have these discussions now. I still see myself more as an analyst and an observer and an advocate, I suppose, not as a player.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I think there's a difference. Yeah. I think you want to catch people's attention. I mean, I want people to read this book partly now to remember what Labour did do.
Well,
there are large numbers of programmes there which are now being obliterated before our eyes, and people forget ever existed. And Labour will have to reinstate, because they were very good. I hope to God Sure Start survives. My guess is it may not. I also want to reach out, I suppose, to voters to say, or reach out to the Labour Party and say, look, this is how much better you could have done.
It's nice that you are being kind of modest. I mean, you are actually a national figure. I mean, you are, you know, you represent a portfolio.
Same to you,
you represent a portfolio of views. You represent a portfolio of views that actually people either violently agree with, partially agree with, or set as a benchmark to disagree with. I mean, in that sense, you know, become a contemporary, you know, Beatrice Webb. I mean, you are, you are, you know.
Well, same to you, most definitely. And the tragedy about the state we're in is that it did seem as if for a brief time before Labour came to power that Brown and Blair were totally absorbed by your vision, which was wonderful. But it turned out that they really just used it as a political tool to kind of bring in that swathe of voters as well. And the moment they were in power, they forgot all about it again. And I think that disillusioned a lot of people right from the start. There were an awful lot of people who got their disillusion in on day one or before day one when they came to power, and partly because they had expected the sorts of ideas you were putting forward to be part of the programme. Once they're in power, they'll start to do it. And they went the other way.
Will Hutton and Polly Toynbee managing to make a squabble out of patting each other on the back. So what does all this tell us about political books? With me in the studio to discuss this is Sarah Crown, editor of the book's website, and Frances Beckett, whose 16 books include most recently What Did the Baby Boomers Ever Do for Us? We're joined on the line from his home by The Guardian's chief leader writer, Julian Glover. Julian, let's start with you. Both Will and Polly are quite ambitious for their books, aren't they? Helping to construct the national conversation. What do you think of that?
I think they do. Both of their books are a mixture of lament for what didn't happen. They've had the government they wanted and it didn't do the things they wanted. And I hope that the next time it happens, if there's a Labour government again under Ed Miliband, it will listen. So they're trying to defend a bit of the record. And certainly Polly's book really is trying to say New Labour wasn't rubbish. It didn't just do Iraq. It did many good things and it didn't just waste all the money. So it's really trying to shape the conversation away from the Tory argument that this was a terrible government that really just chucked cash around and didn't reform anything. And then Will Hutton is talking much more about the generation of wealth, less about the spending of it by government, more about industry, about the need for a science base, for education, how Britain can make its way in the next 20 years. And he, I think, has ideas that all parties will find interesting. I think between him and Vince Cable, we had a speech at the Lib Dem conference, which we haven't mentioned, huge crossover between him and Ed Miliband, huge crossover. I think Ed Miliband read the book before he gave his speech, and indeed with some Conservatives. So I think Will Hutton has more chance of shaping the conversation. He's reaching out further than Polly does.
Mm-hmm. Certainly the commenters on the Guardian website have given it a pretty ecstatic welcome. Sarah, can you take us through their reaction to the extract that The Observer ran?
Yes, this was in last week's Observer, and the reaction was uniformly, I almost go so far as to say positive, which is pretty much unheard of. A poster called Bonds summed up the mood when he or she wrote, "Both this book of yours and Captive State by George Monbiot should be screenplayed and put on TV every night until their message has finally sunk in. They should even be used as educational tools instead of Shakespeare and poetry, neither of which I've used since leaving school." Obviously, I don't agree with that bit, but you see the sentiment there. And they're not all quite as glowing as that, but everyone does seem to be extremely engaged, and he's found a very sympathetic audience here. And one interesting thing was that normally in a thread on politics, there's so much mudslinging and people have such different opinions that, you know, you go through and you see this comment has been removed by the moderator and this comment has been removed. There's very little of that, which is telling in itself, I think.
Mm-hmm. Francis,
just everybody's being lovely.
Now, Francis Beckett is sitting here looking sceptical in the studio.
But I'm particularly sceptical about the idea that books change anything. Probably the most influential political book it's been mentioned for the last several years was Will Hutton's The State We're In. And the fact is, as everybody says, that it didn't influence a single thing about what happened in the real world. What happened was that Blair and Brown simply carried on the tradition of neoliberalism that had been created by the predecessor government. I'm very interested in the discussion too. I think that Polly Toynbee was being uncharacteristically kind to the Blair-Brown administration. The Iraq War was not simply a continuation of the standard British foreign policy of being nice to the Americans, and whenever the Americans say jump, we say how high. Blair was the most slavish follower of American politics ever to have occupied Downing Street, even in the last 50 years when it's been occupied by lots of slavish followers of American politics.
I'm going to stop you there. Sarah, going back to my original premise, which was the success of political books, I've sent you away to look up some facts and figures. What did you discover?
Yes, you gave me my homework this time. Okay, facts and figures. Waterstones reported that the party manifestos this year sold unusually well before the election in May. And then if you go on to look at the more sort of memoir side of political books, Tony Blair's A Journey sold 15,367 copies this week. which is down, sadly, from last week's 26,000. But I guess he won't really be complaining about that. And if you look at the totals from our weekly book charts, it looks to us that he sold something like 200,000 hardbacks in the 4 weeks since the book was published, which would suggest that he's well on target to earn out, which means to repay his publisher's advance. And that's remarkable when you think that the size of the advance was £4.6 million.
So everybody's read it except me, then.
At the other end of the scale, Francis, and I know this particularly involves you, a new publisher's been formed to cope with the demand for... We were discussing what it is exactly, almost manifesto-style books. It's called Bite Back Publishing, and actually your Baby Boomer book was published by them. Tell us a bit about that.
Well, what they do is specialise in publishing books very fast, and They got the first two books out after the election that kind of were instant history. One was by Nicholas Jones, who's the veteran BBC political correspondent, who is really one of the people that the establishment dislikes most, and that's meant as a compliment to him. And the other was Deborah Mattinson's very interesting, wonderfully entertaining book about being Gordon Brown's pollster. And she admires Brown enormously, but at the same time, she can see his weaknesses. She says that she was shopping with her daughter one Saturday morning, and Brown phoned on her mobile and he said he wanted her views on the paper that he'd just sent her that minute. And she said, well, she was out shopping, she wouldn't be back with internet access for at least an hour and a half. And he said, well, then what's your fax number? And that's kind of the Gordon Brown that we all know, the Gordon Brown who is the political obsessive, the workaholic who doesn't really understand how real human beings operate in the real world. So those two books were instant history with all the virtues and all the faults of instant history. They've got the faults in the sense that they're both a bit uncharacteristically rough, a bit uncharacteristically thrown together and unstructured. But in a sense, that's a virtue because they have this feel of immediacy. That's the sort of thing that they specialise in. My Baby Boomers was almost an exception to that, in that it was a book, although it was instant because it's 50 years since 1960, it didn't have
took
the same immediacy.
Years to get
about,
there.
Yeah, it took me 50 years to write it too.
Julian, can I just bring in another book that we're actually reviewing in Guardian Review this week, which is from the new Tory MP Nick Bowles. Tell us a bit about that. It's slightly different in that he is actually an MP.
Yes, I think this is a different kind of book. And what's striking about many British books, political books and the culture, is that they're not by the people in power, they're the people out of power. So we have a whole load of New Labour books come when New Labour's not in office, and you occasionally get ideas books before a party goes in. The Bowles book is striking because it's an exception to that. It's by somebody at the core of the government, the coalition project right now, and a Tory MP, but very close to David Cameron.
It's called Way Is Up, isn't it?
Yes, Which Way Is Up, and he's written this because he feels this coalition was a great shock. It came along, nobody really knew it was going to happen, and if it's going to last and work, it needs some ideological structure explained. He thinks the ideas holding it together are true and exist, but that people need to set them out, and also to look at the next decade. It mustn't just be a short-term government seen in terms of cuts and the October spending review. So he's put forward some ideas, some very provocative. He wants to get people talking, quite a lot on immigration. The argument appeals to some in Labour too, that we've free immigration has really hurt a lot of the poor in Britain rather than benefited them. He talks about the idea of an electoral pact between the Tories and the Lib Dems. Not, I think, something that's going to happen, but something he's at least got people talking about. And that book has made a difference already. The two parties that support the coalition, which he sees as ideologically united, don't fight each other, but instead fight Labour together. You know, Lib Dems are horrified by that. But the Bowles book did put that idea on the agenda before the Lib Dem conference, and people started talking about it. Unlike the other ones we've all been discussing, it's a book that isn't in favour of big government. And people who don't like government often don't write books about what government should do. And Nick Bowles has tried to do that. So it is striking. It's a modern political book, not a retrospective one.
And we actually got John Redwood to review it, who is not known for his left-wing sympathies. And he was rather shocked by some bits of it, by the language of it and the directness of it.
Yes, I mean, to get John Redwood to attack you from the left is in some ways a triumph. And he does point out some of the language on immigration is pretty strong. And of course, Redwood doesn't really believe in any kind of restriction from the state. And maybe restricting immigration, he would see, is an economic interference. And the market should decide labour rates and people should compete on their own skills. And there shouldn't be any state interference. So his criticism isn't necessarily the same as a criticism somebody would make on the left about about immigration, that would be much more on the benefits of a multicultural society.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's an interesting point here about the changing arena for political campaigning. On the one hand, everyone's had to adapt to television and the internet, and that seems to me fundamentally changed the nature of oratory. Nothing can be ever unsaid that's ever been said, and one can think of the famous examples, Edwina Curry and the eggs, or John Gummer and his hamburger at the height of the BSE scare. Julian, presumably, usually, there's quite a bit of caution that comes in with this, which Nick Bowles is not showing at all.
No, well, he wants to be brave, and he wants the coalition to really challenge him, and I think he's perhaps got some license to do that, because he is so close to the people at the centre. He isn't writing government policy, he's not a minister.
So he's a jester, he's like a Shakespearean jester, then, well, since perhaps, this is a books programme.
Perhaps more than a jester, he's saying the unthinkable, and perhaps hoping the unthinkable becomes power. Caution isn't always a good idea in a political book, although it does happen. I remember in the 1990s, Alan Duncan, who's now a development minister, he wrote a book, first of all in hardback, putting forward some very free, very liberal ideas for Conservative Future, which had a big passage on drugs liberalisation, in fact, legalisation. By the time it got to the paperback and Alan's career had advanced a little bit, it had all been toned down. And so perhaps we'll see that too with this.
Sarah, book writing can also be very useful for image management, can't it? I mean, look at, for example, Barack Obama. He's done so well, hasn't he, with the two books, Dreams from My Father, which was actually published long before anybody knew who he was, and The Audacity of Hope.
Yeah, well, just look at the titles, Dreams and Hope. I mean, what better way to set out your stall as somebody who can take things forward into the future positively? And
do we have any writer-thinkers in the new leaderships, Julian?
We've got lots of historians have come into Parliament. I mean, on Labour too, we've got Tristram Hunt, one of the more successful historians of recent years. People like David Willetts, certainly a great thinker.
Ah, yes, now he's a contender with you, isn't he, Francis? Because he wrote another baby boomer book.
Well, he did write another baby boomer's book, but it's nothing like as good as mine. David Willetts fell into the trap, it seems to me, of many politicians when they try to write books. If you're going to write a decent book, you have to not mind too much upsetting people. David Willetts felt unable to do that because he was a front-rank Conservative politician publishing a book in an election year. That's fatal. The very first sentence of David Willetts's book reads, "I naturally owe a very great deal to my constituents in Havant."
Now, let me come in here. I think it's an absolutely fantastic book, and I think it changed the way a lot of people think. And it's a great challenge to be a front-rank politician and to be interesting and write ideas. Any of us can sit as hacks and write a column denouncing the government or praising the government, and we're not really held accountable for it.
But, Julian, in what way did it change thinking? I read it quite carefully, and it didn't change any thinking that I had.
Well, no, you're obviously ahead of us all, and I must read your book. But I think the real skill in David Willetts is the argument that inherited wealth is not necessarily something that is good for society. And, of course, we would then like him to criticise the Conservative Party's policy on reducing inheritance tax, but I think it actually did influence the fact the government hasn't done that. And he did challenge the idea that just a richer society, every individual getting a bit richer, rising house prices, everything we had in the post-war generation, the next generation's going to have, the idea of generational sort of inequality, all of those things, they're not necessarily new arguments he's putting forward, but he put forward as a front-rank politician in a way that was accessible and that people read and will have changed his own party's thinking and his own party's policies.
Well, they're certainly not new ideas. I mean, they're important ideas, and they're ideas that are different from a conservative point of view. Very, very far from being new.
It falls to very few people to have new ideas. I think the key thing is to debate and include and take ideas forward. And I really want politicians to do that and not just have to read other people's books.
Yeah, yes. Now that's a very good point. Now, let's just completely change tack. We've talked about politician thinkers. Let's now go into the business of citizen thinkers, which they're supposed to be the great enabled class by this new technology of ours. There's been a lot of talk about blogs to books, hasn't there, Sarah? Although they're called blooks. I haven't caught up with that one yet. They don't actually seem to have been very successful generally yet, do they?
They were a bit of a flash in the pan, actually. It was at a point when the publishing world noticed how well blogs were doing on the internet, and the publishers got really excited and thought, how can we turn these into books, and thereby completely miss the point of the blog, which is that it's a sort of developing ongoing medium. It's alive and it's happening and it's responsive and all of those things, and you can't put that in a book. But there have been, you know, there have been a couple of people who have done it in a way that has therefore meant they've reached more people. So Salam Pax's Baghdad blog, and he put that in a book, and then that actually was effective because, you know, it reached an audience that it might otherwise not have reached, but by and large, I think it hasn't quite worked. I think they're better off just staying as bloggers, really. Mm-hmm.
But there is a relationship between books and blogs, isn't there? Because, I mean, Ian Dale, for starter, is a very successful blogger who is also a publisher.
Well, there's a growing relationship between blogs and books, a growing relationship between newspapers and blogs. It's part of the, I think, more or less inexorable decline of the whole printed media that blogs are more or less taking over the place in which an awful lot of thinking is being done.
As both Polly and Will said, there's also a huge literary festival circuit where every politician of substance at some point wants to strut his or her stuff. And The Guardian's deputy editor Ian Katz found a perfect example of this when he interviewed the new Labour leader, before he was Labour leader, in Ed Miliband at this year's Hay Festival.
It was notable, I think, at Hay that there were lots of different politicians and actually quite an interesting sort of ecumenical group of politicians. There were wonderful sights of little knots of Labour and Tory politicians wandering around the festival together in a way that I just don't think you see elsewhere. But I think politicians sometimes go to book festivals expecting a perhaps easier ride than they would on other media. And I think that's probably what happened with Ed Miliband and me and Hay.
But I thought you gave him quite a hard time.
I think I did give him a pretty hard time, which is perhaps why the interview ended up being a complete car crash. Some of the people at Hay thought it was a little infra-dig to give him quite such a going over in a cosy book festival environment. But I think actually it might have been quite a useful moment for him to tune his message a bit in a sort of quiet backwater of the campaign, so that when he hit Paxman and he hit Marr, he'd actually dealt with some of the trickier questions that he was going to have to field.
So tell me about some of the trickier questions that you dealt with in that interview.
Back at the start of the campaign, he hadn't yet found a way to frame the choice between him and David in a way that didn't seem like he was dumping on his brother, which he was desperately keen not to do. And I kept asking him in different ways what the choice was between him and his brother. He couldn't see a way of answering that question without being rude to David. And I think as the campaign went on, he realised that you couldn't ask people to vote for him over David without giving them a reason why that was. And he found some subtle ways of doing that, and some less subtle, if you count allowing his camp followers to wear T-shirts that said, "Ed speaks human."
One of the issues on which he didn't come clean and the audience were very hard on him for was about Iraq and how opposed he had been at the time. And it struck me that maybe he'd learnt the lesson from Hay that he'd then played out this week.
That is a good reading. I think what you had in Hay was quite a Guardian reading, Labour supporting audience who really were cross about the war. And at that stage, Ed was saying that he thought the war was probably wrong, but he was also scared of dumping on the record, and his anxiety about that meant that he wasn't able to be frank about the objections that he'd made at the time, even though we knew he had made objections at the time. And I think after Hay, after the start of the campaign, he did become freer about being critical about aspects of the record, like civil liberties, like Iraq, perhaps because he'd had more contact with the sort of anger that you felt in that room in Hay.
OK, so Julian, Ed Miliband not so good in the flesh, but of course there are some politicians who are much better in the flesh than they are on television, in broadcast, aren't there? I mean, I think immediately of John Major.
Yes, and certainly. I mean, I worked for John Major on his autobiography, and a book that benefited from low expectations. Everybody thought it'd be the worst book ever, and the fact that it, in parts, is quite interesting and readable and human, and he wrote it, all played to his advantage. And he did go to book festivals, and it is striking. I remember Gordon Brown once at a Guardian event saying, "Isn't it amazing how people in Britain want to go to book festivals? And isn't this a great thing? And it shows we're a real country." And I think it's that sense of authenticity, that feeling that a politician isn't on the media. We're sometimes blamed, I think, for being the sort of filter between the politician and the people. And that sense of directly being in the same room, being able to ask questions, is enjoyed by both sides. Political conferences have none of that feeling that you get at a book festival of actually something interesting being said.
And did you find at conference, you know, we've all been here sitting in London, you've been doing the rounds, is there an atmosphere of people deep in books, engaging with books?
No, and it's sad. And actually the conferences a few years ago used to have really big, prominent bookstalls. There was one at the Labour conference this week, but it wasn't very prominent. I didn't see one at the Lib Dems. That whole sense of a literary culture being part of living politics is something very difficult to do. What we tend to get is books as gossip and books as history and books as argument, but not really books as what the government is now doing.
And it's really sad, isn't it? Because actually some memoirs can be really important to our understanding of history. Here's an excerpt from the diary of the wartime cabinet official Sir Henry Chipps Channon.
20th of June, 1940. No news yet of the expected peace terms. Opinion is divided. One school of thought anticipates that France will be tempted, indeed lulled, by easy terms. Another suspects that Hitler will demand complete capitulation. I am much encouraged about everything, though I don't know why, and my deep gloom has lifted. But we are living as people did during the French Revolution. Every day is a document, every hour, history. Winston wound up with his usual brilliance and out-of-place levity. His command of English is magnificent, but strangely enough, although he makes me laugh, he leaves me unmoved. There is always the quite inescapable suspicion that he loves war. War which broke Neville Chamberlain's heart.
Chips Channon, giving us history in the eye of the beholder. And there is, of course, another strand which often produces better books, to which we've referred a little bit in en passant, and it's the witty maverick observing from the sidelines. Here's what Giles Brandreth had to say about party conferences.
6th of October 1991, Blackpool. I'm impressed by the way the whole conference is rigged. There are 1,411 motions submitted by Conservative associations across the land, 98% of them pure grovel. This conference congratulates Her Majesty's government. This conference agrees with Her Majesty's government. This conference warmly welcomes. This conference wholeheartedly commends, etc. 2% mad maverick. Bring back matron. Bring back hanging. Let's hear it for the birch. And the ones selected for debate are, quite properly, the ones that will provide the best opportunity for setting out and saluting the government's achievements. All speakers from the floor are carefully screened, and if you have plans for a future within the party, you'll make sure your contribution does the two essentials. Cheers the leader and toes the line. I got a call from central office saying my slot would be Thursday at 9:30 a.m. My theme, Citizens' Charter, and my position, considered adulation. I didn't argue. I'm grateful.
Oh, Brandreth, you are awful, but then you know that. One current contender for this slot is the second volume of Chris Mullin's diaries, Decline and Fall, covering the dismal period between 2005 and 2010. Sarah, Roy Hattersley reviewed this for us. Just give us a few of his thoughts. He made some really interesting points, didn't he?
Yes, he did. One of the first ones, or one of the most important ones, I suppose, is that he wrote, I'll quote him verbatim, that's probably the easiest thing to do, "Part of this book's charm is the fact that its author, although the central character, is not its hero." And that seems to me to be, you know, I guess when you read that alongside perhaps The Journey, it's an interesting...
Julian, this is a grand tradition, isn't it?
Oh, diaries are wonderful. And I think it gets back to that point I was making. People sense this is real. They feel they're getting something that hasn't been interpreted afterwards. Of course, some diaries were actually written afterwards, but I won't name
the cheats,
the
I know.
Suspects that I think have done that. The Chris Mullin diary is totally authentic, and that's one of its charms. I found the second volume a bit less engaging than the first, because in the first he was a minister, a very humble minister in John Prescott's department and in international development, but a minister nonetheless. This latter part of his career, he's really just watching, he's waiting to leave Parliament, he's complaining quite rightly about the horror of the expenses scandal and the way that was reported. It certainly tells you what it feels like to be a politician when people don't like politicians, and he comes across as a wise and interesting and good person.
But he's discreet, isn't he?
It's a bit less engaging about politics, though.
But he withholds names. I mean, this is something that Hattersley actually commends him for. Well, but maybe that's why you find it a little duller.
Lots of diaries are discreet. I mean, the Chips Channon diary that you had that lovely quote from is massively edited and distorted. We still have never been able to see the full Chips Channon diary, and if we did, we'd have a very different view of Chips Channon.
Yeah, it's a bit po-faced, do you think, perhaps?
Well, we lost the sex, and we lost probably the pro-Nazi bits.
Okay, yeah. The third point that Hattersley makes, I have to say, sounds like a cry from the heart of a man who's been much abused. Sarah, you've got to give us this little bit in full.
Okay, yes, he writes, "I would call Decline and Fall genial if I did not fear that it would be regarded as a pejorative description by people who read political diaries to enjoy superannuated ministers being unpleasant about each other."
Ouch. Francis, what do you make of that?
Well, I think we can work out exactly what superannuated ministers he's talking about. John Reid might be an example. Roy Hattersley is one of the very few really good politician writers. By and large, politicians don't write well because of all the stuff they have to read and because they're not supposed to offend people. Very, very few do. Barack Obama is, of course, a wonderful writer. Both those books that you mentioned earlier are beautifully written and speak to you about America. Roy Hattersley is another one. He's racy, he's entertaining, instinctively indiscreet and rude about people.
Now, of course, Hattersley's just done a biography of Lloyd George, which is quite rude about him, but then he's dead, and that's very different, isn't it, Julian? Can we all be rude about the dead?
It's easier. It's although, judging by New Labour at the moment, it's pretty easy to be rude about the living, too. I can't think of many books that have been as directly vicious about living people as the crop we've had from Blair and Mandelson. And actually, the point about the Lloyd George book is that he says at the start that Roy Jenkins, who wrote great books on Asquith and Churchill, never felt able to write about the third of that trio because he really disapproved so deeply of Lloyd George. It's fascinating, Lloyd George's life, because at the time, people in the know knew what was going on and the public didn't. And really, that's how history's left him until books like these.
Sometimes history plays odd tricks, doesn't it? It's like I have a horrid sort of feeling that, like that other great observer, Samuel Pepys, Alan Clark is going to be the politician who outlives everyone.
I think that's almost certainly the case. He and Margaret Thatcher will be forever branded together in people's minds.
Now, Julian, taking us towards the serious end again, you've gone for one of the greats of political writing for perhaps the last word on it, and you've chosen a passage from George Orwell's essay on politics and the English language.
What's amazing about this passage, and indeed the whole essay, is that it's all still true. He wrote it 50, 60 years ago about a kind of political culture that we now look back to and say, gosh, wasn't that a golden age of wonderful rhetoric and Churchill and all of those people? It was just as dreary when he was alive as it is now.
In our time, it is broadly true that political writing is bad writing. Where it is not true, it will generally be found that the writer is some kind of rebel, expressing his private opinions and not a party line. Orthodoxy, of whatever colour, seems to demand a lifeless, imitative style. The political dialects to be found in pamphlets, leading articles, manifestos, white papers, and the speeches of undersecretaries do, of course, vary from party to party, but they are all alike in that one almost never finds in them a fresh, vivid, homemade turn of speech. When one watches some tired hack on the platform mechanically repeating the familiar phrases, bestial atrocities, iron heel, blood-stained tyranny, free peoples of the world, stand shoulder to shoulder, one often has a curious feeling that one is not watching a live human being, but some kind of dummy. A feeling which suddenly becomes stronger at moments when the light catches the speaker's spectacles and turns them into blank discs, which seem to have no eyes behind them. And this is not altogether fanciful. A speaker who uses that kind of phraseology has gone some distance towards turning himself into a machine. The appropriate noises are coming out of his larynx, but his brain is not involved, as it would be if he were choosing his words for himself. If the speech he is making is one that he is accustomed to make over and over again, he may be almost unconscious of what he is saying, as one is when one utters the responses in church. And this reduced state of consciousness, if not indispensable, is at any rate favourable to political conformity.
George Orwell. I find it quite extraordinary that Orwell published this essay in 1946, when I'd always understood everyone was still euphoric after the Second World War. And that's it for this week's podcast. Join us next week to discover who, according to a distinguished panel of children's authors, has written the best children's book of the year. In the meantime, Guardian Review on Saturday will include reviews of Polly Toynbee and Nick Bowles' book and a glorious analysis of Parody by Craig Brown. In the Observer's new review on Sunday, Nick Cohen reviews another commentator's verdict, Steve Richards, on Whatever It Takes, the real story of Gordon Brown and New Labour. And finally, 2 weeks ago we launched a multimedia Simon Callow treasure trail with two signed copies of his book, My Life in Pieces, to give away as prizes. We've now drawn the winners out of the fedora and I can give you the results. The winners are Tracy Heath from Wirral in Cheshire and Phil Darling from Stowmarket in Suffolk. Congratulations. Two copies will be on their way to you any day now. Until next week, thanks for listening. I'm Claire Armistead and the producer is Tim Mabey.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.